my absolute pet hate. My sister and I used to stage race meetings on our bicycles. I'm amazed by how many people don't really understand broadcasting on radio.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. Cornelius Lysett.
I was brought up where Gloucestershire sort of pokes into Herefordshire. I went away to school when I was 8 years old, to a boarding school. We definitely would not have been considered rich, but we were prosperous enough, I suppose, for me to go to two boarding schools. My parents ran a bookshop in Ross-on-Wye in Herefordshire. Ross Books, 42 High Street, and then 49 Broad Street, Ross-on-Wye. Very successful business for quite a long time. And they must have run that for 30-something years, and it gave them a good and comfortable lifestyle. Then when I went into my sort of secondary school phase, I've got a really clear memory of a hot summer and being taught probably classics, Latin. And I can remember the guy concerning, he was called Mr. Cahoon. He didn't have the most brilliant control over his class. I got a bit noisier that year. You know, was coming up with little witticisms and throwaway lines, and people were laughing. Mr. Cahoon wasn't. I always felt I was probably 14 or 15, that was me sort of coming out of my shell to a large extent. I was head boy, actually, at the first school. I wasn't a sports player, so I'm not quite certain how I made that work. But going from 180 boys to 1,200 was a big step forward. And it was initially very hard, especially for someone who, in that environment, was in the bottom 10 or 15, 20% of intelligence, didn't play sports. So I had to work a little bit at that and found myself making people laugh on a few occasions.
Welcome to Just a Minute.
I remember being given a little transistor radio when I was very young. I can visualise it. It was small and the colour was black, and it had a big sort of silver speaker on the front. But it was probably, I don't know, 5 inches by 5 inches. We were a household of Radio 4.
Can you tell us something about that in this game, starting now?
The theme, the radio theme that strikes me most of all, is that for Just a Minute. And my mother always maintained she didn't like Just a Minute, but it must have been on quite a lot, because every time I hear the Minute Waltz, it takes me to lunch at where in the house that I grew up. And I just get new potatoes come into my mind, because in those days, the 6:30 comedy half hour on Radio 4 was more a 12:25, 12:27 lunchtime comedy time. And I promise you, every time I hear that music, I think of new potatoes. We must have eaten new potatoes quite often, I suppose. So many things I listen to on the radio link me straight to something. And the amount of times I work out how long a journey has taken or whatever, because I know where I was when I heard the start of the afternoon play, or where I heard the start of PM. There was never really a good explanation as to why I was called Cornelius. It's one of the many things that you haven't quizzed your parents on, and then you discover it's too late to do the quizzing. But it's not as though it was a family name or anything like that. Well, in fact, I think my mother told me that she met my father and some friends for dinner one night in the town of Ledbury, which was not very far from where I grew up, our local town, and it had popped into her head, so I became Cornelius. There were lots of Marks and Johns and Richards and Roberts and all those kind of names, and then suddenly there was a Cornelius. So I think probably, definitely when I was in my secondary school age, boys will be boys, kids will be kids. And I think I was teased, I hated corny, absolutely hated corny. And then there were various other sort of, because there was a chap who taught me maths called Dr. Routledge, who used to say, Lysett, sit down, Lysett. Learn to use a calculator, Lysett. And because he called me Lysit rather than Lysart or Lysit, which I've been called, then Lysit became Lyshit, etc., etc. So the name, certainly when I was a teenager, was one that I found on occasions troublesome. However, ultimately, in later life, I was able to walk round my regular place of work, i.e. racecourses in Britain and Ireland mainly, because people knew the name Cornelius, and because of the power of radio as well, they felt they knew me. So I've said on a few occasions that however much I hated my parents as a teenager for giving me this unusual name, ultimately I've been very, very fortunate, because if you're going to try and make your way in a walk of life with a slight profile, then if you've got a distinctive name to maybe go with a distinctive voice, then that's clearly an advantage. It was while still at school that I got involved in radio for the first time. It would be quite wrong to call me a celebrity, but I became sort of slightly well known for doing something just completely different. I remember my tutor called it twiddling wireless knobs in the school holidays. But I did twiddle wireless knobs in the school holidays and thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it.
Good morning and welcome to the first day on 7 Sound, broadcasting on 388 metres medium wave and 95 VHF FM in stereo.
The first radio station I worked for was called 7 Sound Radio, 7 Sound in Gloucester. And I started there in the week that Prince of Wales and Princess Diana were married. This was a commercial station in Gloucester. It had been going for a bit, but not that long. And one of the directors was a guy who had a car business in Gloucester, who was a friend of my father's. And I'd obviously expressed some kind of interest. I knew what I wanted to do. I think at that stage, I wanted to read the news. I remember we were a house that where the Daily Telegraph was the newspaper of choice. And we had a big sort of chest fridge freezer in the kitchen. And I used to spread out the Telegraph on the lid of this big fridge freezer and read the headlines as though I was a newsreader on Radio 4. BBC Radio 4, the news at midnight. This is Cornelius Lysit. Bong.
BBC News at 7 o'clock.
You know, I've been doing that for a long time. And my sister and I used to stage race meetings on our bicycles. We had a cassette recorder and a sort of a funny little mic coming out of it. We recorded the commentary around the paddock. We kind of recorded during the race. We must have done something afterwards. And I remember playing it to my mother and someone who'd come in to help. And it's my great regret that somehow that got lost in a house move or whatever. And when I cleared out my mother's house after she died, I was absolutely, you know, everything crossed that somehow I was going to come across a cassette player. But sadly, it didn't happen. Absolutely marvellous to have been able to find that. So I'd showed an interest in the media. I'd showed an interest in the broadcast media. I probably liked the sound of my own voice to a large extent. And then my father said to this guy, Oliver Blizzard, who ran a car company in Gloucester, you know, you're a director of the radio station. Can you help? And Oliver said, well, look, I can't get you a job. I was at the time 16. And so I was soon to start my A-level period. He said, I certainly can't get you a job, but I can get you an interview with the programme controller at 7 Sound, who was a guy called Eddie Vickers. So this 16-year-old went to see Eddie Vickers, and I wasn't really a rah-rah-rah sort of public school boy, but I think in that environment I'd have probably been thought of as that. And I went to see Eddie. He introduced me to Jeff Barrett, who was the news editor there, and I met a couple of other people. I wasn't pushy, I don't think. They said, well, you know, would you like to come in? And then you end up in a local radio station. I think there was a telephone call from somebody who'd got some story relating to the big national story of the week, the wedding of Charles and Diana. I think it was something to do with getting thieves having nicked rail tickets or something. It was something like that. And the news editor said, well, why don't you do something on that? And so I think I'd been there about 2 seconds, and there I was sitting in the newsroom actually putting a story together. And I think I was reading bulletins not that long afterwards.
The news every hour on 7 Sound.
So I must have spent some time there in July and August of that year, then back to school, autumn term I'd have done something there, definitely Christmas. That Christmas into January of 1981-82 was a severe snow, and it'd been forecast, so we knew it was coming. And I was thinking, gosh, I cannot be stuck at home when I've got this sort of really exciting sideline of being able to do some work in a local radio station. I cannot be stuck at home snowed in for days. It'd drive me mad. It'd drive them mad, my parents mad. So the snow had just started, and I walked to the end of our lane. I was 16, so I wasn't able to drive. I've never hitchhiked before in my life, just not my sort of thing at all. But with snow coming down, and I was probably looking a bit like the abominable snowman, gradually more and more covered in snow, I hitched a lift, but whoever the first driver was only going to the first town, which was, it was 17 miles to Gloucester from where we lived. The first car was only going to Newent, which was about 4 or 5 miles down the road. So I got to Newent. The snow was coming down, but I was absolutely determined to get there. And then I hitched again and got into Gloucester just in time to then work in the radio station. And we had a thing called 7 Sound Snow Alert. We also had, at different times, 7 Sound Flood Alert, because the River Severn between Gloucester going up towards Tewkesbury and beyond was flooded quite seriously. And I lived in the New County Hotel in Gloucester for a few days. I think I lived a bit with Jeff Barrett, the news editor, and there was a reporter called Graham Gardner. I lived a bit with him as well. It was sort of, I suppose, it was a Dunkirk spirit that this weather had come in. But, and this was something I learned really clearly then, just how important radio is, and even more then than now, but how significant radio is when there is some kind of a drama, whether that drama is snow in Gloucestershire or whether now something happens. My first instinct now continues to be to turn on the radio. It was an extraordinary time because we were a lifeline for so many listeners. This is obviously pre-mobile phones, pre all the rigmarole and all the technology that exists now, but we were a lifeline.
You've got a friend on 7 Sound Radio.
67 Southgate Street, Gloucester. I think it had been a pub. So it had a sort of frontage bit, which was a reception with receptionists and some offices. Then through the car park to the studio area at the back. It was not big at all, the newsroom. Six of us were very much squashed into the newsroom, and this was a time pre-computers, so I can still hear the clatter-clat of the typewriters in my mind's ear. And then the smell has sort of come back to me. There was a very fresh smell about you. You had to push quite hard on this big sort of solid noise-proofed door to get into the specific studio area. And there was a large studio on the right where most of the programmes came from, a talk studio in the middle, and then one which was used as a sort of spare. And then there was a little news studio as well. I spent a lot of time in there because I don't know whether other people didn't want to or whatever, but I just read quite a lot of bulletins. Yeah.
You got a friend. 7 Sound Radio 7 Sound.
It's all gone now, the whole thing, but I can got such a clear memory of looking through the little window from the news studio into the main studio where there was a guy called Steve Ellis who presented the breakfast show. I remember him being very friendly, very chatty about this, that and the other. A guy called Christopher Musk
who at the program meeting every week used to insist on being called Christopher J. Musk, in case there were any other Musks in the area. Alan Roberts, who I'd actually heard on Radio Oxford when I was at boarding school in Oxford. I discovered that Radio Oxford was at the entrance to the road in which the school that I attended was. And we actually had a trip, bringing back all sorts of memories, this. We had a trip to Radio Oxford while I was there. That must have absolutely encapsulated me. And I think Alan Roberts, who then was at Seven Sound later, I think he'd been there. Andy Westgate, that was his jingle. Seven Sound itself had a fantastic jingle. From the Cotswolds to the Forest of Dean, this is Seven Sound. Your sound in stereo. And many, many years later, I can reel that off the top of my head like I'm still there now. It was small, it was cosy, everybody knew each other. Eddie Vickers was the managing director and programme controller. He was quite accomplished. And I think the station as a whole, under his guidance, did fairly well. And from a newsy point of view, because I was there during school holidays and then I got a job for a bit. Then I went off to Sussex, to Southern Sound, the start of Southern Sound Radio in Brighton. I hated it. Basically, I was much too young to be doing it.
It's 7:45 on Monday, the 29th of August, 1983. Welcome to Southern Sound.
The start of the radio station was so exciting. And I was involved with the breakfast show. I think I did travel news. And then did newsroom tasks until lunchtime. And Louis Robinson was one of the presenters. Stuart McIntosh was another one. Russ Williams, he was the other trainee starting at the same time as me, who's made a big name for himself in music presentation. Paul Woodley was the news editor there. But I was too young to be doing it. I didn't drive. I was too young. I was in a town that I'd never been to. I lived in Hove, actually, rather than Brighton itself. I was in a town where I didn't know anyone, wasn't as confident as I should have been, too young. The job itself was great fun, but I hated living in the hate bit. I just didn't enjoy being in Brighton and came back to Gloucester. Gloucestershire was a really newsy area at the time. There was lots of good stuff going on, just sort of stuff that happens. Various members of the royal family were moving in. Prince Charles purchased Highgrove. Princess Royal purchased Gatcombe Park. Prince and Princess Michael of Kent lived in a wonderfully named village called Nether Lippiat. So there was a lot of royal stuff to talk about. And then, what was it, 83? The telephone rang one day and I answered it. And this voice said, I'm Inspector bloody blah from West Mercia Police in Worcester. And I said, oh, hello. And he said, yeah, we're ringing around to tell you that we've arrested a man under section bloody blah, bloody blah, A, B, C and D of the Official Secrets Act. So I said, what does that mean? And he said, it means he's a bloody spy. This was a guy called Geoffrey Arthur Prime, who was convicted of spying for the Russians at GCHQ in Cheltenham. And people didn't really know what GCHQ was. I remember going past this great sort of sprawling complex. In those days, it was as you came into Cheltenham from the Gloucester area. I remember going past with my parents as a child when we went shopping in Cheltenham. I'm being told it was a communications centre, and I honestly thought it was something to do with the AA. Anyway, GCHQ became not just the top story in Gloucestershire, the top story in the country during the mid-80s. And unions were banned at GCHQ. There was Geoffrey Prime, the spy. You know, we were able to do documentaries, I think, all centred around GCHQ, which in the 21st century is quite a well-known institution. But at the time, it was a lot more hush-hush and provided good story after good story. I remember, sadly, another member of staff at GCHQ had been found dead. I remember the news editor writing a voice piece. We didn't really have anything for the voice piece for the inquest. And he said the public gallery was packed, including by Secret Service officials. And I said, well, how can you say that? And he said, I remember him saying that day, that there is no way there won't be secret, you know, you've got to be, you don't want to be making stuff up, but there will be Secret Service people there, so you can get away with a certain amount of license. We did everything from GCHQ to still my favourite story that we did in the entire time that I was at Seven Sand. It was to do with a bottle bank in Wootton-under-Edge. And I remember that one of the reporters there was called Ivor Ward-Davis, Ivor Ward-Davis. And we used to call him Ivor Ward Details in the newsroom, because he always wrote and hid the cues to any voice piece. Ivor Ward-Davis has the details. And anyway, I was reading this script one day and he'd written, a big question mark hangs over the bottle bank in Wootton-under-Edge. And it was just ridiculous. In my mind came the image of this question mark hovering over the bottle bank in Wootton-under-Edge. And he had written, as always, Ivor Ward-Davis has the details. So, and that was the first time I did what all of us ended up doing lots of times, was Ivor Ward Details has the Davis. I was keen and enthusiastic and probably not being paid very much money, and probably didn't think that it was any beacon on the road to anything greater. But by grabbing an opportunity at the time, it gave me a wonderful grounding. I was there then. Once I'd come back, I was there for 3.5 really, really happy years.
Seven Sound with your friends. With your friends, 388.
There were many good things about Seven Sound. And I was living in Cheltenham, which is a vibrant town for a young person to live in, and great, great fun sharing a house and sort of behaving badly in the way that people do. But the massive advantage from my point of view was that one of the most famous race courses in the world was right in the patch. So I was very friendly with the sports editors. There was a guy called Nigel Dean, who was the first sports editor, who then went off to TV. And then Graham Gardner, who had been a reporter, became the sports editor. And he gave me the opportunity to present, I think it was called Sport on 7, 7 Sport, something like Sport on 7. I can't remember the exact name of the programme, but I have such a clear memory of presenting the programme when Watford were playing in the FA Cup final. Well, that is mid-1980s. And Elton John was very involved with Watford, and I remember we were playing, you know, I'm still standing, and will he still be standing at the end of the game, whether, depending on how Watford get on.
Don't you know I'm still standing better than I ever did?
Graham Gardner put an immense amount of trust in me to do that programme, and there was a guy called Damon Page-Jones, who was son, actually, of Oliver Blizzard, who'd helped me at the start. He ran the show, Damon. And I remember Graham was on holiday or had a weekend off or whatever, and we went for a cup of coffee to discuss it. And he said, well, the first thing to say is, I've got to take my hat off to you for getting through that. It was probably on from 2 till 6. It was a 3 or 4 hour programme. It was sport, and it was a bit of music, and I knew nothing about music. So Damon, the studio manager, was having to write down the names of some. No, literally, I know much more about music now than I would have done at all at the time. He said, no, I take my hat off to you for getting through the programme, but, and I suggest, you should have done this, you should have done that, bloody blah, this, that and the other. It was fine, but it could have been even better. So that was a really significant moment for me, and I think I did it more than once. I did it a few times, I think. But Cheltenham was there, and the Cheltenham Festival, which was then 3 days, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, we had to have some sort of presence there, and nobody would have been particularly enthusiastic about going, but except for me. So I was off and running to Cheltenham. I was doing some reporting at Cheltenham. Must have been starting to do the same kind of stuff that later I did for quite a long time for the for the BBC, and I worked at Cheltenham as well, worked for the race course in the build-up starts at the beginning of February. So I was working in the office, just taking orders for tickets to go in. And Edward Gillespie, who was the man who ran Cheltenham race course at the time, he was my mentor. We got on exceptionally well. He had lots of interesting ideas, and he came to me and he said that he wanted, when people bought their tickets in advance, he wanted them to receive something with their tickets that would promote the events. So I produced these cassettes for the big race meeting that they have in November and for the festival in March, so two a year. Basically, it was me doing interviews with horsey people, trying to keep it as general as possible so it wasn't too time dependent. Interviews with sponsors, interviews with the race course. Then I put it together with the aforementioned Damon Page Jones. And these cassettes were sent off with the tickets when people ordered them. That was a massive break, really, because it was the dream, you know, to actually be able to be doing some proper media stuff. And I was making a tiny bit of extra money out of it as well. It was fabulous. And then late 80s, I was talking to Gillespie about whatever, and I had to go to London. I said, I'll come in and see you tomorrow morning, but I need to be away by a certain time because I've got to go to London. And he said, well, I've got to go to London. I'm planning to go on the train. You know, will you give me a lift to London? And I said, no, it'd be great. I went and had my meeting. We got in the car and we drove to London. And I said to him that I'd had this thing in my mind, this dream in my mind of an event radio. So I actually called it Racing Radio. So he said, oh, go on. What are you thinking? And I told him, well, I think it would start at, say, three or four hours before the first race. We'd have programmes previewing. We'd use the race course commentary during the afternoon. And we'd have a review programme at the end of the day. And, you know, going back to what I'd been doing on the little cassette recorder at home with my sister as we raced on our bicycles, we were just doing that kind of thing, but for rather more seriously. I said, I want to call it Racing Radio. You know, I think it could work. So he said, well, we're not calling it Racing Radio because you'll just go to other people and try and sell it to them as well. We'll call it Festival Radio, but let's go for it. You had to get licenses. You had to get license to play. We played music as well. I found two guys. I remember they stood out at the races, which is Cheltenham races is all sort of quite, especially in those days, but even now, quite sort of tweedy, quite formal. And these two guys who ran it had hair down to their, practically down to their,
a long way down their backs anyway. They did look slightly as though they'd come to the wrong festival, but they ran it brilliantly, all the technical side. And Festival Radio was born for the 1989 Cheltenham Festival, and it still goes today. And it's grown to other race courses. And I think what Edward liked about the idea was that he'd been to the Open Golf at where it had already, that kind of thing was already happening. And obviously, if you're on a golf course, it's really important because it's so vast. Even on a race course, it's a really useful thing for people who are attending to have as an extra aid to follow in the day. And we ran it. I was so nervous for the 1989 festival. And as it turned out, that 1989 Cheltenham Festival was a big one because Desert Orchid, the racehorse of the time, they called him the Flying Grey because he was grey. He was almost white. And he jumped. He flew through the air when he jumped. So he was a huge sporting star at the time, Desert Orchid. And he won the Cheltenham Gold Cup of 1989. And if I'd started Festival Radio and it had been a dull festival, not that there really are dull festivals, but if it had been a bit sort of slightly nondescript, the enthusiasm might not have continued, but that we were swept along on the wave of enthusiasm which surrounded Desert Orchid winning the race that day. It poured with rain all day and they thought the race meeting was going to be off. Yeah, but it turned out to be a real success. And Cheltenham Racecourse, where I'd gone as a child with my father, I'd been there as a reporter. I remember actually the reporting day, the first mobile phone I ever handled was at the Cheltenham Festival 1987, and it was snowing.
And there was a sort of rickety stand in the middle enclosure, sort of the other side of the racetrack from the main enclosures. And some people had clambered on, in the snow, had clambered onto the roof to get a better view of the racing, and the roof had collapsed. So I was sent with this enormous mobile phone, so, you know, that old cliche, the size of a house brick, it really was, and went over to this enclosure. And then I was going to record a voice piece for not just for Seven Sound, but for the IRN network. And when you were called upon to do a voice piece which ended Cornelius Lysett, IRN, Gloucestershire, it was just, the excitement was enormous. And the significance of doing that and doing it well in order to progress was not lost on me. I was due to record a voice piece from the middle of the race course, sort of next to this stand which had collapsed, and I don't think anyone had been seriously injured, but it looked as though they might have been. It was snowing. I dialed through to Seven Sound, and there was a delay and another delay, and I think it was for the 3 o'clock news, IRN news. And suddenly I thought, crikey, how are we going to pull this off? Because, you know, it's for the 3 o'clock news, and it's 2:56, 2:56 and a half, 2:57. And I was saying, you know, when are we going to struggle to turn this around? And the voice just came down the line and said, you're doing it live. So I'm standing there on this mobile phone, not really knowing exactly what's going on because no one did. It was snowing. It was Cheltenham. So there were lots of people around the place. And I had to do this voice piece live. And that was probably the most nerve-wracking. I can hear it now. It's 3 o'clock. This is Alan King. He was presenting the bulletin, I think. He was one of my great favourites of the IRN newsreaders. And I did it live, and thank goodness. And I found this throughout my broadcasting career. If you have to do something live, it's extraordinary how often you get it right. Well, if your mind knows that you're recording it, it'll probably be take 103 before you actually get it right. But happily, things worked out well that day. Edward Gillespie at Cheltenham Racecourse got me a job working for a telephone company, a company which put racing commentaries on the telephone, which was considered unbelievably cutting edge in 1986-87. 0898 telephone numbers, was it 0891? I think it started as one and then became the other. This organisation was called Race Call, and there was a lot of nudge, nudge, wink, winking, because the phone numbers, I think, certainly to start with, all started with the same four-number prefix, whether it was racing commentaries or it was sort of some kind of porn line. So I'm sure my parents' friends were convinced that I was working for a porn line in London. Literally, you dialed the number and you heard the commentary of the 1:30 at Sedgefield or the 3 o'clock at Bath or whatever you dialed in for. And there was, bearing in mind, I don't think there was TV in betting shops at this stage. There weren't the specialist racing channels there are nowadays. So therefore, it wasn't that easy actually to follow a race. And we were providing this service. And we had various sort of people coming in presenting sessions, one of whom was Peter Bromley, who was the BBC's racing correspondent. So we're in the late 80s. He'd already been racing correspondent of the BBC for nearly 30 years.
Here comes Troy! Troy has come to cut them down for time! Troy comes sweeping first to take the lead!
And he, to call him a legend almost devalues him. He was an enormous person in British sports broadcasting. There were a number of very big characters at the time and big voices. But you had your well-known people like your Dan Maskells and your Bill McLarens and your Peter Alice's. And you certainly had Peter O'Sullivan doing racing on the television. But Peter Bromley, for me, I'd been listening to him since I was at school. What I used to do when I was at school was to go on, I think Cheltenham was Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And I think a couple of those were half days, or I used to take the afternoon ill or whatever, and I used to just go and sit in my bedroom listening to the coverage of the Cheltenham Festival. And that was Bromley calling in the 70s and early 80s some of the, well, all of the great horse racing events of the time. So I found myself working with Bromley, who at the time couldn't get his tongue around my surname. He called me Lissagged, I think. Anyway, we got on all right. And it transpired that Radio 5, as opposed to 5 Live, Radio 5 precursor to 5 Live, was starting at the August bank holiday of 1990. And one of the things they wanted to do was to sort of reinvent the Wogan's winner from the Terry Wogan show in the 1970s. And Bromley put my name forward as a possible presenter of that. And I went to see Mike Lewis, who was the head of sport. It wasn't really an interview. I think it was slightly, do you want to do it? Just check that he liked the cut of my jib. And I started then on that August bank holiday of 1990 at what was then Radio 5.
You're listening to BBC Radio 5 on Monday, the 27th of August, 1990, as the clock ticks towards the launch of Britain's first new national network in 23 years on 9.09 and 6.93 a.m.
I think it started at lunchtime on the bank holiday, Radio 5. And I was on for the first time on the following morning. So I was there in the first 24 hours. And I presented racing previews a la Wogan's winner, which had been a horse racing preview on Radio 2 in the 70s. And I did a couple of slots, two or three slots, every single morning. And I started at the end of August 1990. And I think when I left the BBC on the 30th of April 2020, I think I was about the only continuous broadcaster who'd been there from pretty much day one, through Radio 5 and its various guises, through 5 Live, and finally I hit the finishing line, so to speak, on the 30th of April 2020. So it's what started that August bank holiday with doing these 2 or 3 minute racing bulletins on Radio 5 went on a very long time.
With Rivaretto showing the way through Silver Season and Sunday Bill, Shergar a close third. Then comes Al Nasser for France, the only French runner in the race now. Then Church Parade.
Bromley and I had worked closely together. I think I irritated him. I know I irritated him in quite a number of different ways, probably. He had one of the great BBC voices, and when he called home Shergar in the 1981 Derby or Red Rum in the 1977 Grand National or Desert Orchid when he won his Gold Cup, when he called those big events, they were absolutely massive. And he in the great traditions of broadcasting, he had the voice, he had the vocabulary, he had the ability to describe and to come out with a great noise as well, and great descriptions and great commentary. He wasn't quite so keen on the reporting side of things. That's definitely where I wanted to go. So I think he probably felt, to use a racing analogy, that I was trying to nip up his inner, which I wasn't really, because I fancied the commentary a bit, but it was the reporting and the storytelling that I was really into. So he probably said to his friends in the 90s, "Oh, I've created a stick for myself here. Because here comes Cornelius and he's trying to do this and do that, and et cetera, et cetera." And he announced his retirement, that he was going to go in 2001. And he was robbed of his last Cheltenham Festival, because the Cheltenham Festival of 01 was off because of foot, didn't take place because of foot and mouth. But he did the Grand National of 2001, and then he retired on Derby Day 2001. It wasn't a massive change, really, because I was still doing the reporting. I was called, right, that was the main change. Here's our racing correspondent, Cornelius Lycett, instead of Cornelius Lycett Reports. I suppose it gave me more confidence, a bit more stature. But I did a bit of commentary, but there was a commentator at that stage, and then he left not that long afterwards. And then John Hunt, who's became the long-serving horse racing commentator for the BBC, he came along. So, yeah, I knew I was following a leviathan of the turf. Normally, it's bookmakers called leviathans of the turf, but I think it's appropriate to call Bromley a leviathan of the turf. He was a big character as well. He was deaf in one ear, so there were certain things he didn't hear. So it could be lively working alongside him, put it that way. And then the sad thing is he died only almost to the day, 2 years after he'd retired, which was a great sadness. But personally, I kept doing what I wanted to do. But I think because Bromley had been there since, Peter Bromley had been there since 1959. Now, he was old-fashioned. He did make one a bit nervous. One was wary around him. So when he retired, there was an opportunity. I felt there was an opportunity to modernise the coverage of horse racing.
Well, here is Anthony Oppenheimer, the winning owner breed. I'll let you come down the stairs, sir. I want to know what it feels like to have not just owned, but to have bred the winner of the Derby.
I mean, sort of something, my ambition of life is a breeder. I never thought I would, and now it's happened.
And to fulfil that, so to put into words how good that feels.
Well, it feels wonderful. I knew, you know, if my father was still alive, he'd be over the moon.
But there were a couple of producers at the time, sports producers, one called Jonathan Wall and another called Mark Sharman, both of whom I got on with really well. And they were quite up for doing something a bit different that would help them make their names. And both of them have made very good names. So the Cheltenham Festival of 2002, we decided to do in a different way. There were probably more laughs, probably a bit more racing stuff that wasn't too horsey, if you like. And it was a completely different sound. John Inverdale would have been presenting it, but it was a different sound. And Inverdale was very up for a bit of modernisation as well. So we'd started the programme from the jockey's sauna in the weighing room at Cheltenham. And that was sort of our signal that we were doing things a bit differently. I don't think any microphone had been inside the jockey's sauna before. And then we were put in, you don't put yourself in, so we were put in by Five Live for a Sony Award for coverage of Cheltenham that year. And I think there were four runners in our category, one of which was the late Queen Mother's funeral coverage. I think, so it wasn't sport, I think we were in an event category. Anyway, I think there were four runners, and we were the 33-1 outsider of four. I remember walking down the street with Mark Sharman saying, I've just been practicing what I'd say if we won. And I remember him saying, don't be silly, we won't win this. And would you believe it, we did win it. Sony gave us the gold award. And Mark Sharman and me and Jonathan Wall, we all started walking up to the stage thinking, oh, we're gonna hold court here for a minute or two. And then from the other end of the room, there was John Inverdale walking across the room as well. So we ended up, all of us, on the stage receiving our trophy from Edith Bowman, Paul Gambaccini, the MC that night. And that was one of the great nights, not just of my working life, but of my life as a whole, because it seemed like the plan to modernise, to make this sport, which is baffling to many people, a little bit more user-friendly and a bit more accessible. It felt this was public recognition in front of our peers that we'd actually pulled it off. I think we celebrated like it was a massive, massive night. I remember getting home when it was just getting light, just getting to bed, and the phone rang. I thought, who on earth is this? And it was the late John McCrurick, who was the kindest, most decent guy imaginable, despite all his noisy, arm-waving antics on TV. Just wanted to ring up, just read you won it. Absolutely brilliant, he said. John McCrick was a huge icon of broadcasting, but particularly racing broadcasting at the time. And I closed my eyes to go to sleep, totally content. It was the icing on the cake that I'd been recognised with a telephone call from John McCrick on top of a brilliant night. BBC Racing winning a Sony.
Don't back Cigar. 3-5 on, 6-1 hauling. It's extraordinary. I reckon it will not be lit up, Cigar. It'll be stubbed out and broken. They're going to break Cigar. Don't you dare back Cigar.
Radio is all about painting a picture, isn't it? That's not breaking news to say that. And you've got to describe, as with all commentary, whether it's cricket or football or whatever, you've got to describe the action. So we've got to get the winner right. We've got to get the first, second and third. But there is so much more to it than that. And that is what I really wanted to do when taking over Correspondent, which is the storytelling side of it.
From Northern Lad as we rejoin Cornelius Lycett.
And what a contrast to 12 months ago. I think three times as many horses still standing as they run on towards Valentine's. Northern Lad and Blue Charm and Brave Highlander and Feels Like Gold. The stragglers are still coming towards it, but the leaders are going on now towards the next. And they come to it now and rise.
In terms of the commentary, and Blue Charm. I have done bits of commentary. I used to do a section of the Grand National where BBC Radio has certainly in the past, has had four commentators spread around the race course. You've got to know the colours to identify the horses. And then I suppose in something like the Grand National, it's a case of just mentioning as many names as accurately as possible. But as with all commentary, there are other things to add in. And I've wanted to bring it alive by A, painting the picture of what's here today, but B, a bit of context in terms of history and heritage. C, a bit of geography. This absolute standing joke, a producer that I had called Steve Rudge, he used to laugh every time, every race course that we went to, I had a geographical description. So Lingfield was under the flight path into Gatwick. That was the one that we always, he used to say bingo very loudly when I said, and here we are under the flight path into Gatwick Airport when we were at Lingfield, or Cheltenham at the foothills of the Cotswolds, or York just outside the ancient city walls of the city of York, or wherever.
Because this race course at Epsom on the Surrey Downs, we're what, 15, 16 miles from central London, but on the southwest tip of Greater London, it sort of snakes across the downs here. You go uphill, then you've got a sharp left turn.
Newmarket, where they've been doing this on the East Anglian flatlands of Newmarket since the days of James I and Charles I and Charles II.
It's a proper test of a horse, and it's been happening since 1780.
So it's painting quite a big picture of the actual action, but also of the stuff that goes around it that makes it... What is radio meant to do? It's meant to entertain, but inform as well. That's what Lord Reith wanted to happen. Of the little I know, I've learnt a lot of that through different aspects of racing, whether it was mental arithmetic, knowing the difference between 6-4 and 13-8, whether it was geography, knowing that Fontwell was near Chichester, or whether it was history, knowing that Royal Ascot has been going on in its current form through various kings and queens of England since the early 18th century. And I want to sort of pass a little bit of that on. Funnily enough, when I left the BBC, a colleague and very good friend, the football correspondent, John Murray, he said to me something along the lines of, I'll miss not knowing what the weather's like when I'm tuning in on a Saturday, or, you know, where the race course is. And although I would never claim anything as grandiose as to have a house style, but to mention the weather and mention where I was and any heritage was definitely part of the whole thing. And the fact that I knew I did it, but no one had ever mentioned it. And when John mentioned it, that was great. And then various social media platforms, people said, how am I ever again going to know where some obscure race, Fakenham? Where is Fakenham? Where is Cartmel? Or wherever. And obviously those aren't remote places for those people that live there. But in terms of the country as a whole, they are a bit more remote. The canvas is wide. Of course, you've got to give the nitty gritty of what happens. But also, you've got to contextualise it in such a way that people... And that is the crucial thing with... And it's not just racing. Whether it's racing or golf, or whether you're working in the science field or you're working in politics or whatever, you've got to appeal to people, your natural constituency, ho-ho, politics, but your natural constituency, and to people who aren't you're naturally interested in what you're doing. And I'm very proud of the fact that people, when I announced I was leaving the BBC, you know, quite a lot of the messages that came were along the lines, never had any interest in racing or no knowledge of racing, but have really enjoyed listening to you. And I thought, all those people got replies, because that was A, a very nice thing to say, and B, it was very satisfying, so I wasn't completely useless.
Priti Patel has been on the sidelines for some time, but she's making a move now. And it's no secret that Gavin Williamson is tracking them along with another contender, once renowned for his use of the whip, Mark Harper, and not too far behind.
The actual commentary isn't really my particular area of expertise. I was the amateur who could tell the difference between horses A, B, C and D, and get the message across.
And a great success for the British thoroughbred breeding industry. Once upon a time, the backbone of flat racing was the owner breeder, the grandee of flat racing, if you like. There hasn't been
but a those victory commentators for a in whatever sport they're doing that can really, when you think there's no new level to go to, and John Hunt, who's the BBC's horse racing correspondent at the moment, would be as good an example as you can find.
He's six legs clear again now.
he has got that timbre in his voice, or that level in his voice, or that control of his voice, that, you know, you're going to the last and it's XYZ who's in front coming, and he's fallen, you know, to be able to go up again. It's a remarkable talent. It's relatively few people. So regardless of the vocabulary that a commentator's got to use, a commentator must be able to control their voice. And that is just really, really hard. You know, just shouting across the room or whatever, everybody knows how hard that is to do, to not make it sound shrill or whatever. John Hunt of the current BBC people, John Murray, Conor McNamara, I'm so envious of him doing football with his voice. Ian Dennis is another one. It's just really hard to get to that. Ian Robertson was absolutely, he managed to do it year in, year out, Ian Robertson with the Rugby Union. To have that control of the voice is very, very hard. And I remember doing a few races and, you know, just talking to you. We've been talking for a bit and my throat gets quite dry and my voice just will not do what I ask it to do. You know, that is a great knack, a great art to be able to pull that off. And John Hunt, I'm sounding like the John Hunt fan club, but he is one of the many good people that I am responsible for bringing into the BBC. Probably one of my proudest things at the BBC, I'm going to sound really arrogant now, is I brought in John Hunt, who's turned into an outstanding sports commentator. Claire Balding brought her in, who's turned into an outstanding sports broadcaster. A guy called Luke Harvey, who was a jockey, I brought in, who's turned into an outstanding racing broadcaster on ITV. And I mentioned a couple of producers earlier on. Jonathan Wall, who was racing producer, went on to be controller of Radio 5 Live and controller of BBC Sounds. Mark Sharman's very distinguished producer. And Steve Rudge is head of football production now at the BBC. So I always take the view, I might as well blow my own trumpet because no one's going to blow it for me. But I like to think that part of everything was, you know, I'm probably wasn't the easiest person to work with because I am quite pernickety. I'm quite a stickler, but we got into some good habits, and I like to think that they picked up on those good habits and ran with them. But John Hunt, going back to John Hunt, he does racing and he does swimming, and they are the two most challenging sports of all, really, because on the whole, if you're doing tennis, you've got to be quick, but you're probably not having to go to a massive level, occasionally, but not that often. Golf, ditto. Rugby, obviously, you have to be able to, and football. So great to be able to control voices like that. But what John does, the speed, the levels he goes to, the control he has of his voice, and the vocabulary, it's an astonishing skill. And people like me in the 1960s and 70s, listening to the radio, dreamt of doing that stuff. It's a great dream to have, but it's a lot more than just sort of doing a bit of gabbling for 5 minutes. Or as Mark Pugach always says, a bit of blah, blah, blah for a few minutes. It's a great deal more than that.
Good morning from central London, a bright, crisp morning. And this is unusual as well, being in the media. In the written media, I should say, Daily Mail, Daily Telegraph there as well. And I can just confirm the news that I'm leaving the BBC in 2020 after just...
The headline in the Daily Mail said, "I feel as though my insides have been ripped out." Now, I can't actually remember using that expression, but I know the guy who wrote the piece, so he didn't make it up. But that's exactly how I felt. Was I surprised? Yes and no. No and yes. BBC's had to cut back on finances, and racing is not the sport of kings. It's not it is still the sport of kings and queens, but it's not, unfairly, not got the following, not got the wide reputation that it deserves. So, yeah, when the news was delivered, I suppose I'd thought about it lots of times, but as with everything, when people have done it for a long time, you've thought about it and you thought, no, it's not going to happen, is it? So, yeah, it was really, really hard. And they were kind enough to give me quite a few months of notice. So I think it was 7 months' notice, something like that, 6 or 7 months' notice. And then got down to the final furlong. And it was very hard. The hardest thing is the deadlines. That's what's great about working. Well, the hardest things, plural, were these. They were the deadlines, because the excitement when you've got to, in radio, probably more than any other broadcast medium, on a station like Radio 5 Live, you're working to half-hour deadlines. And the excitement to have to get your thoughts together and communicate them decently and get from A to B is just, it's the most exhilarating job that you could have. And just really missing, and this quite likely sounds pretentious, and I know there'll be plenty of people I've worked with who will consider it pretentious, but I don't think they understand radio in the way I feel I understand radio, which is, you know, the listener, the intimacy with the listener, the thought that you are coming out. I still think of the box in the corner of the kitchen, the box in the corner of the bathroom, the box in the garden, the car radio, the radio in the workplace, the little radio under people's pillows, all that kind of thing, the noise coming in through those little tiny earbuds into people's ears. I miss the intimacy of talking to the listener every day. I hesitate. I'm only going to use that expression, the listener, once, because it is that I hate it. It's my absolute pet hate when people refer to the listener in the third person, because the intimacy of radio is it's we. It's me talking to everybody. It's whichever other presenter talking to the listener. I'm amazed by how many people involved in radio don't really understand broadcasting on radio. It's an old cliche that you talk like you're talking to somebody leaning against a bar in a pub or sitting across a table suitably social distance in a cafe. That is how you're meant to broadcast. And there are an immense number of broadcasters who just don't really understand radio broadcasting and that intimacy, and that's a pity. It's not meant to be somebody, the millions of people around the country or around the world or whatever, eavesdropping on some ha-ha conversation between person A and person B. It's meant to be everybody involved, and that really annoys me when, if you're going to ask me in a second what annoys me about radio, be ready for a long answer. I think there are a lot of people that don't really understand radio broadcasting. I feel I really understand it, and I miss like mad that intimacy with people who are listening at home, in the garden, in the car, in the workplace, or wherever.
Not a lot more to say than that. Five more months to work hard, and then looking forward to the next chapter, or indeed chapters.
What am I planning next? Horse racing. I think it's the longest organised major sport certly in the UK, probably in the world. It is a much better sport than some people think. There are some great stories to tell. There are some great people to bring to life. And in the third decade of the 21st century, there are so many ways to do it. Podcasts are obviously a principal thing, but also being able to use the various social media platforms to do live stuff. So those are certainly on my mind, to try and pass on some of the stuff that I've learned, some of the enthusiasm that I've gained, some of the insight that hopefully I'm able to provide. So hopefully do a little bit of that in the future. But I was about to say horse racing is all I know, but that's not actually the case, because I do know radio, and it's not going to happen, because the radio stations don't happen like this in quite the same way anymore. But if somebody came along and said, would you like to run a radio station, or actually, would you like to come and run a race course, to be part of a community, to really be something a community can rely on, then I'd love to have a go at that. Obviously, I go to sleep dreaming of owning a racehorse that wins one of my favourite races. That is unlikely to happen. But so much has been about dreaming about talking and communicating with people via the radio about a great sport.
the dreams continue. And I've been lucky enough that the major dream of my life came true for a very long time. And as I've said quite often, we were asked when I was at school aged about 12, 13, 14, chap taught English called Mr. Graham Campbell, Angus Graham Campbell, and he asked us to write an essay about what we'd be doing in middle age. And I probably wrote down practically to the word pretty much exactly what I ended up doing, which makes me an extraordinarily fortunate person. I'll tell you my one regret, something I didn't pull off as successfully as I should have done. You need to stand up for your corner sufficiently, but not so strongly that you end up being sort of marked down as a member of the awkward squad. And that's a really difficult balancing act to pull off. And in broadcasting, if you've got a good story, if you've got a good event, you've got to stand up for that event, but you haven't got to bang the drum so hard for it that you end up, or bang the drum too often as well, that you end up being just sort of marked down as a member of the awkward squad. And I probably didn't bang my drum too often because I was realistic about the fact that however good the 2:45 at Newmarket is within the context of horse racing, you know, we are talking about one sport and a big sort of sporting world. But so I didn't bang my drum too often, I don't think, but I probably banged it a bit hard on occasions. So that balancing act of standing up for yourself but not becoming a member of the awkward squad, or being perceived as a member of the awkward squad, I pulled off quite a lot of the time, but not all the time. I'd like to be remembered as somebody who brought to life a sport that is baffling, an area of life which is baffling to many people. There are many baffling areas of life that various correspondents, reporters, specialists have got to do their best to try and make as easy to follow as possible. Racing is certainly one of those. And I feel, to use an expression that I have used quite often to various people, I feel I didn't do an entirely bad job.
Cornelius Lycett. For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast. I'm David Lloyd, and if you are interested in radio techniques, then do grab my book called Radio Secrets. Radio Secrets is the title. It's got many, many hints in from the wise about all aspects of broadcasting. That's Radio Secrets, available in ebook or paperback on Amazon and everywhere else.